The lucrative trade which Comex had developed by his simple device of having befriended a weeping bootmaker about to have his neck slit attracted the attention of many Zavir men, who wondered why they had not thought of importing shoemakers from Matamoros. But no one paid closer heed than General Quimper, who said one afternoon as a new rush of California-bound men clamored for boots, "This dumb ox has a gold mine." It offended Quimper, offended him deeply, to think that a reprehensible man like Comex had stumbled upon such a bonanza, and he felt it his duty to see that the manufacturing operation, as he called it, was brought under honest control. He could think of no one better qualified to exercise such control than himself, for he spoke Spanish, knew men of property who could afford to buy the boots, and obviously was reliable, for he had both land and money. To accomplish this transfer, General Quimper needed the cooperation of either a judge or a sheriff, and in Frontier, Texas, both were available to a gentleman of good standing, especially if he came from Tennessee or Alabama and had some gold coins in his pocket. Yancey decided upon a three-pronged assault, so one morning Judge Kemper summoned Comex to his chambers. "Panther, you could go to jail for bringing in those Mexicans." There was no law forbidding this, for law-abiding Mexicans had always been free to cross the Rio Grande. But the judge's manner was ominous, and it was substantiated by a visit from Sheriff Bodger, who said, "Us sheriffs in these parts got our eye on you, Panther, and your illegal operations." The convincing blow, however, fell when six gunmen appeared at the workshop, threatening to shoot everyone in sight if they didn't get the hell out of Texas. Quimper himself, terrified of a brute like Comex, did not make an appearance till the threats had softened up the wild man. Then he appeared, unctuous and reassuring, to deliver the good news that he could protect Panther and square things with the law by taking the offending Mexicans off his, Panther's, hands. By this simple but effective strategy, General Quimper obtained control of the bootmaking operation, and it must be conceded that once he got it, he knew what to do with it. Advertising in both Houston and Austin, he visited the many United States Army forts, peddling his excellent boots to the eager officers. And he established the designation General Quimper Boots as effectively as Samuel Colt had made his name synonymous with good revolvers, or as John B. Stetson would make his with hats. In the great war that was about to erupt, generals and colonels fighting for both the North or the South were apt to wear the heavily ornamented Quimpers, as they were called. But very few enlisted men would have them, unless they stole them from the bodies of dead officers. Yancey did not find it comfortable selling to enlisted men. The Cobbs now had 11,000 acres, Reuben having acquired 800 more of relatively useless river-bottom swamp, and to run it they had 98 slaves, not all field hands. Since, from long experience, the owners had learned that one strong field hand could effectively tend only 10 acres of cotton and 6 of corn, this meant that much of their land had to lie idle, and this was just what Reuben had intended. Today those bottom acres look like nothing, but time's coming when they'll be priceless. When someone asked why, he smiled, for what he had in mind was to dike them in, play farmer's roulette, and make enormous crops when the great floods stayed away, lose everything when they came. But even when floods do hit, he told his cousin, we win, because they bring down fresh silt from somebody else's place to enrich ours. The Cobb cotton fields were like no other in the area, for they were hardly fields at all, merely open spaces between tall trees, so that in early March, a slave with a plow could never follow a furrow for very long before being stopped by one of the trees. And when in late March the plants showed their pale green heads, they did not appear like proper cotton at all, but rather like patches of green thrown helter-skelter. However, if the fields lacked neatness, they did carry signs that 3 years from now they were going to be masterpieces, because each tree, which now prevented proper cultivation, had been girdled and was dying. In 2 years it would wither, and in 3 it could be pushed down and the stump drawn. Reuben did not propose to be girdled, not by nature, which he battled, nor by northern abolitionists, who threatened his prosperity and his way of life. And he was more afraid of the latter than the former. Nature you can control. If the great flood comes, you hunker down and let it come, then use it later to your advantage. At Lakeview, there were 3 bottomlands: the low bottoms, which were underwater much of the time, the middle bottoms, which presented a reasonable gamble, and what might be called the upper bottoms, which had been underwater centuries ago when the streams were powerful, but which now were relatively secure against flooding. In these rich upper fields, the Cobbs had planted their first crops, and on them built their homes. Reuben was not worried about the ultimate worth of any of his fields, and since he had reassured himself about the permanence of the great raft, he was satisfied that his water supply was guaranteed also. It was his slaves about which he worried, for in a distant land like Texas, where replenishment was not easy, they were of considerable value, and if he should be deprived by northern guile, he would lose not only his investment in them, but also his capacity to work his plantation. The worth of an average adult male slave in Jefferson had increased to $900, a female to $750, and since he and Set had brought with them only the best, their investment, forgetting the children, stood at something better than $60,000. Since the value of a good slave seemed to rise steadily, he could anticipate that with natural increase by birth, which he figured at 2.15% per year, and the judicious purchase of new slaves from farmers going out of business, by 1860 he and Set ought to have no less than 150 slaves worth more than $1,000 each. This was property worth protecting. He was therefore most attentive when a northern newspaper writer named Elmer Carmody arrived in Jefferson. Carmody told everyone quite frankly what he was up to. "I'm writing a series of essays on the New South, Alabama, Mississippi, Texas. We already know about the Old South, but Texas is of powerful concern to northerners." He talked with anyone who would pause, and showed an intelligent interest in all details of plantation life, taking careful note of financial and husbandry details. As he went about in the small town, he heard repeatedly of the Cobb brothers, as they were called, for the size and ambition of their plantation excited admiration. "Mister, they have the best mill in the whole South, old or new." Several Jeffersonians volunteered to drive Carmody out to Lakeview, but he preferred to take things easy, and on the 5th day of his stay, Reuben Cobb did indeed drop by to see him. "We hear you're writing about us." "I propose to." "Unfavorable, I suspect." Carmody extended his right hand palm down and rotated it up and down to indicate strict impartiality. "I write as the facts fall, Mr. Cobb, and the facts I've been hearing tell me that you and your brother, cousin, he's from Carolina, I'm from Georgia. Would I be presuming?" "To my mind, you're presuming by even being in this town. But if you want to see a plantation at its best, I'd be proud to have you ride back with me." Reuben was on horseback, and he naturally assumed that Carmody had a mount. And when the newspaper man confessed that he didn't, Cobb hastily arranged to borrow one from a grocer with whom he did business, and soon the pair were heading out to Lakeview. "I hear that you have more than 10,000 acres. Why were you so willing?" Carmody rarely had to finish a question, for Cobb had such an acute interest in everything, he could anticipate what data an intelligent man might seek. "We believe in Texas," he said, turning sideways. "We're willing to invest all our savings." "What did the land cost you, on the average?" Cobb was surprised. No Southerner would dream of asking such a question of a plantation owner. Forbidden were, "How many acres? How many bales?" Next, Carmody asked, "How many bales do you hope to ship?" And before Cobb could answer, he asked, "Is it true you have your own wharf?" By the time they reached Lakeview, Reuben actually liked Carmody, for in his brash 26-year-old way, the young man asked probing questions without a shred of guile, doing so in such a rational progression that Reuben wanted to answer. And when the four adult Cobbs met with Carmody, who stayed with them 3 days, the conversation became extremely pointed, with Reuben asking at the beginning of the first session, "Are you an abolitionist?" And with Carmody replying, "I'm nothing. I look, I listen, I report." "And what are you going to report about us here in Texas?" "That you are the last gasp of profitable slavery." "You admit, then, that we do make profits?" "You do, but not for long, and at a terrible cost to your society." Reuben flushed, and there might have been harsh words, for he was a voluble defender of the South and its peculiar traditions. But he also wanted to hear a logical explanation of the Northern point of view, so he restrained himself and asked, "Why do you say our obvious profits exact a terrible cost?" And Carmody launched into a careful analysis. Let us suppose two recent immigrants go, one like you to Texas, another also like you to Iowa, two states that joined the Union at about the same time. You each bring to your new location the same amount of cash, the same amount of intelligence and energy. I'm afraid that the man who goes to Iowa will, in the long run, have every advantage, and the cruel difference will be that he will not be encumbered by slaves, and you will. The difference will manifest itself in every aspect of life, but principally in two vital ways, manufacturing of goods and self-government. Let's take manufacturing first. Because the Iowa man has no slaves, he can rely on no ready crop like cotton. He must work in many different fields, and when he does, he builds skills. Pretty soon everything he needs to live on is available locally. If he wants a bricklayer, he can hire one. If he wants an engineer, he can ask about the neighborhood, and soon he has produced a diversified society capable of supporting itself by the exchange of money for services. The man who comes to Texas with his slaves cannot do that, for he must apply all his own energies and that of his slaves to growing one cash crop, cotton. Now the profits from cotton can be great. My studies satisfy me that even a poor farmer can produce his crop for 7 cents a pound. But with good management, you can bring it in for 5¾ cents. And then, even if you have to sell at 7, you prosper. And if you can get 16, you make a fortune. I know that in many years you do even better, but you must buy more slaves and more land. What happens when the land gives out? Your profits are not invested in the creation of a multiple society. Now and next year, and for all the years to come, when you need something, you must send to Cincinnati to find it. You are not producing those useful things upon which a complex organization depends, and down the road a way, you're bound to pay a terrible price for this neglect. 8 or 9 times during my travels, I've heard sensible men say, "We may have to go to war someday to protect ourselves from the Yankees, to protect our sacred way of life." And the speakers have convinced me that they mean it, and that their young men are the bravest in the world. But, Mr. Cobb, if the North has all the production, all the railroads, all the arsenals, all the shipbuilders, it must in the long run prevail, no matter how gallant your young men prove to be. And before you argue me down, let me say that the gravest price you pay for your slave economy is the tardiness it encourages in the building up of government, of education, and of the good agencies of society. You have no public schools, because half your population, the Negro half, does not need them. Your friend in Iowa will soon have libraries and publishing houses, and you will not. He will have lively politics divided between reasonable factions, and you will have only the party dedicated to the preservation of slavery. This is the terrible cost of your peculiar institution. You ought to abandon it tomorrow. Each of the four Cobbs had a dozen points on which to debate Carmody's thesis, and he proved responsive to all of them, listening sagely, nodding his head agreeably when they scored, and shaking it when they indulged in fantasy, not fact. He really was seeking information, and they believed him when he assured them that he was not an abolitionist. I truly have no preconceptions. I've studied Adam Smith, and have learned from him that economy governs a great deal of human effort. And the more deeply I probe into the economy of the South... What is this word, economy? Pettipru asked. It means everything we do at work and trade. For example, the most interesting thing I've seen at Lakeview, and let me tell you, this is an impressive plantation and you're impressive people. No, you guess what's been most interesting. The Cobbs guessed that it was their manufactured lake where none had been before, their multipurpose mill, perhaps the girdling of the trees and letting them stand in the midst of the cotton. No, Carmody said. It's that slave Trajan. He runs your mill, you know. Gin, press, grist, saw, he does it all. Frankly, he's a better mechanic than any I saw in Iowa. And you must have in these fields around Jefferson. He threw his arms wide to include all this part of Texas. He had become so excited that he lost his line of reasoning. Ideas cascaded through his mind with such rapidity that this sometimes happened. Tell me, he said, is that great raft I saw at Shreveport, is it there forever? When the Cobbs assured him that it was, he said, remarkable. But then a great deal in this part of the world is remarkable. For two more days he talked with the Cobbs, and on the evening before his departure Reuben said, You know so much about us, I'd like to hire you as manager. And Carmody replied, You've almost convinced me that plantation life can work. And Somerset asked, But you leave here still unconvinced? And he said, Yes, this way of life is doomed. Its economy must deteriorate. Now that's where you're wrong, Reuben cried, leaping to his feet. If we can keep moving our slaves westward, we can maintain this paradise forever. Carmody stiffened visibly, and Pettipru wished her husband had not spoken so openly, for she knew the young visitor must respond. He was the kind who did. Mr. Cobb, the nation will not permit you, will never permit you, to carry your slaves even 10 miles west of Texas. Reuben flushed, and his neck muscles grew taut. Whereupon Pettipru said blithely, I've prepared a small libation in honor of your departure, Mr. Carmody. And the tempest was avoided. But just before retiring for the night, Carmody said something which caused Reuben to fall silent. Up on the Red River, I met this Methodist preacher, man named Hutchinson, not a very good preacher, if you ask me, in the pulpit, I mean, but a man of profound wisdom. He told me that he's been teaching slaves in that district to read and figure, and he's found that some of them were distinctly clever. On the day that Elmer Carmody left Jefferson, Reuben Cobb and two neighbors rode north to the Red River, a distance of only 60 miles to the Indian Territory, and there they made quiet inquiry as to the comings and goings of this Methodist minister, Hutchinson. When they had him well spotted, they enlisted the aid of several local plantation owners, and in the dark of night they apprehended the lanky, weepy-eyed man and tied him to a tree, warning him that if he continued preaching insurrection to slaves in the district, they would kill him next time. Then they lashed him till he fainted. Leaving him tied to the tree, they returned to their homes. Just before Christmas 1850, the Cobbs met General Yancey Quimper, and were at first impressed by the man's bearing and his obvious patriotism, although they differed as to the amount of support they wished to give him. Reuben, always on the hair trigger where Southern rights were concerned, and looking far forward in his defense of slavery, thought that Quimper made a great deal of sense in his opposition to Henry Clay's notorious Compromise of 1850, which restricted the spread of slavery, and he supported Quimper with special vigor when the general objected to the part of the compromise which delineated the boundaries of Texas. "Look at this map, what they did to us," Quimper cried as he explained how Congress had stolen immense areas of land from what should have been Texas. "We won all this territory from Mexico, won it with our guns." "Is it true that you led the infantry at San Jacinto?" Somerset asked. "Most powerful 16 minutes in the history of Texas," Quimper said. "In those flaming minutes we won all this land, and now Congress takes it away." His map was compelling, for it showed the original Republic of Texas in 1836, bordered on the west by the Rio Grande, in such a way that Santa Fe was part of Texas. And there was also a panhandle, which stretched all the way into what would later become the states of Colorado and Wyoming, encompassing much of the good land of New Mexico and Oklahoma. "If we'd have kept this," Quimper stormed, "we'd have been one of the major nations of the world." Somerset tried to placate him. "General, you forget that Congress paid us $10 million for our rights." "No honest Texian would ever sell his birthright for a mess of potatoes." "We call ourselves Texans now. The old days are gone." "Aha!" Reuben cried. "Did you hear that, General? First time my cousin used we when speaking of Texas. Always before it was you, like he was a visitor here." "I feel myself to be part of Texas," Set confessed. "And while I can't see the other states allowing us to hold all that land, especially up in the north, I do think we ought to have had the upper reaches of the Rio Grande as our western boundary." "Exactly," Quimper shouted. "Then we'd have Santa Fe as a counterbalance to El Paso." With a broad and generous hand he gave away Colorado and Wyoming, but with hungry fingers he drew Santa Fe back into the Texas orbit. The cousins were at first charmed by this affable man with a very attractive wife. The general was now 38 years old, fleshy, clean-shaven, and often prophetic when peering into the future. "Worst mistake Texas ever made, gentlemen, was when we sent Sam Houston to the United States Senate. Hell, he don't represent the interests of true Texans or the future of the South." "Wait a minute," Somerset interrupted. "I've seen pamphlets in which you and Houston fought side by side in getting Texas into the Union." "We did, that we did. Even a habitual drunk can sober up sometimes and do the right thing. But he's a man who cannot be trusted, never could be." Reuben said, "They tell me you had a chance to shoot him in that duel, and that as a gentleman you shot off to the side." "Worst mistake I ever made. Sooner or later, somebody's going to have to handle that old drunk." When Quimper left Lakeview, the Cobb cousins remained confused, because so much of what he said was true, so much of what he did was false. And it was during these days of review that Reuben and Set began to draw apart in their judgment of the man. Reuben, always thirsting for action, was eager to associate himself with Quimper, and was uneasy lest the tall talker initiate some campaign without including him. But Set, a cautious judge of men, grew more suspicious of Quimper the more he thought about the man's behavior. In this he was abetted by Millicent, who said simply when they were alone, "He's a fraud. Couldn't you see that?" "I did see it, but I also saw that he makes great sense when he talks about South and North." "Easy. Listen to him when he talks, but leave him when he begins to act." In 1854, Yancey Quimper rode back to Jefferson with a band of 19 Southern patriots who were determined to move Kansas into the slave column. And he was not only prepared to march them right into that area, but also to help them in disciplining any Northerners who might have slipped across the border. He was so excited, so persuasive, that Reuben Cobb rode north with him. They entered Kansas quietly, in 3 separate groups, and spent 2 weeks listening to accounts of Northern perfidy. For 15 days they did nothing except scout the land and establish escape routes in case a superior Northern force attacked. Of course, at this time there was no Northern force, superior or inferior. but they did come upon a pair of isolated farms occupied by families from Illinois, and these they surrounded and attacked on their last night in the area. "No killin'," Quimper ordered as his men crept closer, and his command was obeyed, for the Texans ran at the houses shouting and yelling, and so swift were they in executing Quimper's commands, they had possession of the farms before the occupants could think of gunfire. The families were herded onto a hillside, where they watched as torches were applied to the rude homes they had built with painful effort. "You go back where you belong," Quimper warned them. "Your kind is not welcome here." When the vigilantes returned across the Red River, recognized by Congress as the northern boundary of Texas, they learned that Reverend Hutchinson, the Methodist minister who had been punished before because of his incendiary work among slaves, was still up to his old tricks. So Quimper, Cobb, and three others rode out to his parsonage and hanged him. The group then separated, Cobb heading east to Jefferson and Quimper south to Sevier. But each carried a promise from the other. "When the trouble starts, you can rely on me." When Elmer Carmody published his travel book, Texas Good and Bad, he could not have foreseen that his carefully considered judgment on two types of Texas community, English and German, would place the residents of the latter in mortal danger. First, his generalizations about the typical Texas town of that period. South of the Brazos, I stopped overnight at the hostelry of one Mr. Angany from parts unknown. He had four guests that night, but explained to us, "I ain't got no food in the place, savin' some cornbread and lard and sugar." That's what we ate. He had no blankets either, and his two beds, in which four of us would sleep with all our clothes on for warmth, were lice-ridden. He also had no hot water for shaving, no chamber pot for convenience, and very little hay for our horses. Charge, $1.50 for man, 85 cents for beast. In this frame of mind, Carmody chanced to move west from Austin, which he considered a pitiful excuse for a state capital. Worst in America, all spittoons and greasy beef. And in his casual wandering, he came upon Fredericksburg, which he extolled. It was with these gloomy reflections that I turned a bend in the Pedernales River and came upon the two beautiful stone houses of the Allerkamp family. And immediately I saw them, I realized that I was passing from barbarism into civilization. The trees were trimmed, as trees should be when they stand about homes. The lawn was green, and flowers were confined to neat beds upon which someone had spent considerable care. The well-designed houses were of stone, with no open spaces for the wind to enter, which I had been accustomed to on my Texas travels. And over everything there was a cloak of neatness, of respectability, of the very best husbandry. As a practiced writer, Carmody realized that for an outsider to venture into a sensitive area like Texas and offer comment on its way of life was hazardous and bound to excite criticism. But even he did not appreciate how inflammatory it was to compare the Germans so favorably to the barbarians he encountered elsewhere. Especially dangerous were his comments about white cotton growers. I had been assured since entering Texas that the cultivation of cotton could be achieved only with the work of slaves, and that no white man could possibly plant and harvest this demanding plant. I saw that the Germans of the hill country did very well with cotton. They grow it efficiently, bale it more carefully than others, then watch it bring a marked premium at Galveston, New Orleans, and Liverpool. Fredericksburg proves that most of what Texans say about slavery is nonsense. A writer has certain advantages. He can publish such evaluations, then scurry out of the country. But his words remain behind, generating bitterness. And in the years following the circulation of Carmody's Texas Good and Bad, other Texas citizens began to look upon the Germans as aliens who refused to enter the mainstream of Texas life, as cryptic abolitionists, and even as traitors to the fundamental patriotism of the state. When General Quimper visited the Cobbs, He found them incensed at what Carmody had written about them. But they had not finished voicing their grievances when he interrupted, "Gentlemen, it isn't only his infringement of your courtesy that should bother you. What can you expect of a writer? It's his praising of the Germans, and particularly what he says about slavery." He took the Carmody book and read with emphasis the passage about growing cotton without slaves. "That's treasonous. The time could come when we might have to teach those Germans a lesson in manners. They invade our land and then try to tell us how to behave. If we catch them tampering with our slaves..." He had touched upon one of the strangest aspects of Southern life. Many slaveholders were convinced that their slaves, at least, were supremely happy in their position of servitude. But at the same time, the owners were desperately afraid of slave uprisings or of Northerners inciting their slaves. There was a constant tattoo of hangings, beatings, and terrible repressions whenever it was suspected that the happy slaves might be surreptitiously preparing a general slaughter. Thus there had been fierce punishments meted out when it looked as if the slaves might rebel at Nacogdoches, and white clergymen had been hanged at the Red River on the mere suspicion that they had been tampering with their loyal slaves. Any serious consideration of punishing the insidious Germans was forgotten in early June of 1856, when word reached Texas of the insane behavior of John Brown and his sons in Kansas. "They've murdered Southerners," General Quimper cried as he carried the news from house to house. And before the details could be verified, Quimper and Reuben Cobb were back on the trail to Bleeding Kansas. With the 19 men who accompanied them, they formed a powerful support for the Southern agents, who were trying to ensure that, if a plebiscite ever occurred, the vote would favor slavery. Of these 21 vigorous defenders of the Southern position, only 4 owned slaves. Quimper was not one of them. And only 13 had come into Texas from Southern states. But all were willing to risk their lives in defense of the South. As Quimper himself explained, after a wild skirmish in which 4 abolitionists were slain, "You have a strong feeling that God intended things to be the way they are in the South, and any man can see that the welfare of Texas depends on our standing shoulder to shoulder with our Southern brothers." When Cobb and Quimper reached home with the exciting news of their victories in Kansas, 9 abolitionists killed without the loss of a Texan, they started to try to whip up enthusiasm for some kind of vague action against the Union. But now they ran into the iron-hard character of Sam Houston, who was determined to protect the Union and keep his beloved Texas firmly within its protection. Quimper, an able man where political savagery was required, led the fight to humiliate the old drunk, as he still called him. "He sits there in the Senate of the United States and does everything possible to humiliate Texas. Always he votes against our interests. He might as well be an abolitionist." His charges were partially true, because in these closing days of his life, Sam Houston, now 64, dropped the vacillation which had sometimes clouded his character, and came out strongly and heroically in favor of preserving the Union, regardless of the offense to local preferences. "I support the Union which has made us great, and if there are any temporary imbalances, they can be corrected." When pressed, he admitted that he was now and had always been a strong pro-slavery man, but that slavery could be protected and even advanced within the existing structure, and he begged his fellow Texans to protect it in that constitutional manner. In a time of threatening chaos, he was a constant voice of reason, and when others talked with increasing passion, he became more conciliatory, imploring his friends, North and South, to retain the rule of common sense. When he had felt that to preserve the Union he must vote for the Compromise of 1850, because he saw it as the only way to prevent dissolution, he had been denounced as a traitor to the Southern cause. And when he spoke even more forcefully against the shameful surrender of the 1854 Kansas-Nebraska Act, he was vilified. It was as a consequence of this general disfavor into which Houston had fallen that General Quimper devised a clever manipulation to show Houston and the rest of the state just how deeply Texas now despised its former hero. "Let's show the old fool we mean business," Quimper argued. "Let's elect his replacement in the Senate right now." His term has 2 more years to run. Such a rebuke has never before been given. "We'll do it, and he'll be the laughingstock of the nation." And forthwith, Quimper bullied his fellow Texas state senators into designating Houston's replacement while he was still in office. But Houston was a fighter, and in 1859 he astounded Quimper and his cronies by announcing that since he was being denied his Senate seat, he would run for the governorship of Texas on a platform of preserving the Union. Aware that sentiment was veering against him on this point, he mounted an intensely personal campaign, crisscrossing the state and applying his unusual powers of persuasion. People swarmed to meet with him, listened, rejected his program, but supported him personally. Some felt that the old Indian lover could solve the Indian problems that agitated the western counties. And when the votes were counted, this man who swam against the tide had won, capping a career unmatched in American history. Congressman from Tennessee, twice elected governor of that state, twice president of the Republic of Texas, United States Senator, and now governor of the state of Texas. He had known more ups and downs than any other major figure in American politics, for after almost every victory, there had come defeat. Now, with the Union in peril, he would launch a heroic defense of his principles. It was not going to be easy. General Quimper, encouraged by Houston's foes, dusted off his old anti-Houston pamphlet of 1841, the one written by another hand, and added a salvo of subsequent charges. "We have known for many years that Houston is a drunk, a bigamist, a liar, a land office crook, a despoiler of ladies, and a coward who avoided battle and an honest duel whenever possible. But did we then know that he was also an enemy of the South, a betrayer of the interests of Texas, a cheap tool in the hands of abolitionists, and a stealer of public monies? That is the real Sam Houston, and he is powerless to deny even one of these charges, because the entire nation, and Texas in particular, knows they are true."